Okay, just to quickly get through the beginning part of our material, we're going to talk about authorship, John himself for a few moments, the day of writing. But again, I just want to do that in a cursory manner because of the fact that we've already done this with the first two epistles, and especially 2nd and 3rd John, very similar with regard to time of authorship. You'll notice in verse 1 of 3rd John, the writer refers to himself as the elder, as is the case in 2nd John. And while it is true in both of those cases that John does not explicitly identify himself in the text as the writer, instead using that exhortation of the elder, that is something that is universally recognized and acknowledged from the very beginning, that these letters were written by him. The letters are very similar in tone to one another. Also, there is much similarity between 2nd and 3rd John and his first epistle, though his first epistle is a bit longer. There are some things that we're going to talk about in the discussion questions as to those similarities. And even, as we noted, that you can go to the Gospel of John and look at some of the strands of themes and such that go through the Gospel that are very similar. A lot of language is similar to the three epistles that he wrote that were found at the end of our New Testament canon. So, though there is not an autograph on the letters, there is very little disagreement with regard to the authorship. It is acknowledged by all that indeed he is the one who wrote that book. Now, I don't want to spend much time talking about John himself, again, because we've done this already in 1 John and a little bit in 2nd. But to acknowledge that he was one of the original apostles. He was an intimate of Jesus Christ. Among the apostles, there is perhaps more known about John than anyone other than Peter. And of course, we would add Paul to that as far as those well-known who were apostles, just because of the forward place that he takes in the narrative, beginning the middle of Acts, all through the remainder of the New Testament. But he was not one of the original 12. But John was one of the best known of the disciples, and also one of the most prolific writers when you add the Gospel with the three epistles, though the latter two are two very short books. Anybody have any questions concerning the authorship or anything that you would like to add concerning the apostle himself? Again, these are some things that we've discussed in some detail in previous weeks. Okay, then the only other thing we want to make note of is that when we consider when the book was written, there is no way to ascertain that exactly. All you can do is go by basically the fact that he calls himself an older person. In verse 1 of both 2nd John and 3rd John, indicating this was late in his life. As you go, you can find some things to indicate, how old he was when he died in exile. There are the traditions concerning those kinds of things. For example, there are two different views taken concerning the time in which the book of Revelation was written. Those who hold to the idea that it was a late date give credence to the external tradition that John died in exile while on Patmos, the island that he was on when he wrote the book of Revelation, and say that he died probably about AD 96. And again, depending upon which version of the calendar you're coming, it may be a few years either side of that. But as a result of that, if we talk about him being fairly old at the time of this writing, the date that is generally ascribed to both 2nd John and 3rd John, as we've already alluded to, is about 89, somewhere around there. So this is one of the last books that were written during New Testament times. And by the way, as we talked about a little bit in 2nd John, with regard to the Gnostic heresy, Gnosticism didn't come around until after the close of the New Testament, but the beginnings of it, the incipient error that that erupted into full-blown Gnosticism after the close of the New Testament canon was around the latter part of the New Testament writings, and there are references to it. We're going to talk more about that as we talk about Jude's epistle in the next few weeks. But there is some indication of it as well in both 1st and 2nd John. We talked about 2nd John a little bit later, a little bit last week, concerning the denial of the humanity of Christ. Those who deny that Christ was human are anti-Christ. And as such, that gives more credence to the fact that the book was written later on, or near the end of Paul, of John's life, near the end of the New Testament canon, because that kind of error was beginning to creep in among brethren and was being dealt with by Peter in 2 Peter, by Jude in his epistle, by John in both 1 and 2 John. Not in 3 John. That's not what is under consideration in 3 John. But all the signs indicate that these letters were probably written at about the same time. So much so, you look at some of the language that is used concerning the salutation, concerning the final comments. It's almost like John had sat down and he had a couple of short letters he needed to write before he went somewhere, and he almost wrote a form letter. I mean, it's not form in the sense that it's uncaring or unfeeling, because it's certainly not that. But there's some striking similarities between the greetings and salutations of both 2nd and 3rd John. So it lends credence to the idea that it was written late in his life, that it was written at about the same time that 2nd John was written. But all of these things are somewhat speculative. It's important that we kind of try to give some context concerning these things before we get into the word studies, that you'll have some background information about. Now, having said that, the only thing that really is of any significance with regard to the introductory material that we supply for all these books that's different between 2nd and 3rd John is the person to whom the letter is addressed. This is a very specific letter, and as we alluded to in our study of 2nd John, where we are told that the letter was to the elect lady and her children, there is a specific individual who's under consideration and who is addressed in the third epistle that John wrote, and this time it is a man by the name of Gaius. If you'll notice in verse 1, the elder to the beloved Gaius, whom I love in truth. Beloved, I pray that you may prosper in all things and be in health, just as your soul prospers. For I rejoice greatly when brethren came and testified of the truth that is in you, just as you walk in the truth. I have no greater joy than to hear that my children walk in truth. Now, if you're looking at the letter, and we'll read through it in just a few moments' time, you'll notice that greeting that is given. And there is a few verses 5 through 8, where the apostle takes time to commend Gaius because of his faithfulness and his hospitality. And then there are just 4 short verses 9 through 12, where he deals with talks about what it was that he was writing for, the purpose of his writing. And that was to deal with the specific problem that existed in the church of which Gaius was a member, a man by the name of Diotrephes, who was usurping authority and was being divisive. And so he deals with that. Expresses his characterization of Diotrephes, explains what it was that Diotrephes was doing wrong, exhorts Gaius not to be like that, and then gives his final farewell greeting in verses 14 of the text. Very simple, and I think in this case an easily understood letter. We've had some interesting discussions and some very deep discussions as we've gone through these series of studies, but 3 John is something that's relatively straightforward, and I think that we probably will cover the material fairly quickly. But concerning who Gaius is, there's absolutely no way of knowing who he is. And you'll notice in the material there are 3 men by the name of Gaius that are mentioned in the New Testament, other than the mention of this Gaius here. So there's potentially 4, but there are 3 men that are referred to. The first one is referred to in Acts, the 19th chapter. Gaius of Macedonia, who accompanied Paul in his travel and was taken, grabbed by an angry mob for a short period of time in Ephesus in Acts 19, verse 29. Then Gaius of Derbe, who met with Paul in Troas. There's a mention of Gaius from Derbe in Acts, the 20th chapter, in verse 4. You'll remember that that Paul had stopped in Troas, tarried there for 7 days. On the first day of the week, they gathered together, and he preached for them until midnight. It's on that occasion that this Gaius of Derbe had met with the brethren at that place. And then finally, there is a Gaius from Corinth who is mentioned in Paul's first letter to the Corinthians as one of two individuals that he himself had baptized. You'll remember when there was the vision that existed in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, the Apostle Paul is dealing with those issues, and some were saying, I am of Paul, I am of Apollos, I am of Cephas, I am of Christ. And Paul didn't want to participate in such divisive spirit and didn't want to in any way be responsible for it. So he basically said, none of you should be saying I am of Paul, because I didn't baptize any of you except for Crispus and Gaius. Now he goes on and talks about other things, but that's kind of an indication. Why in the world are you saying such things when this is a carnal mindset? And so that Gaius, one of two men that were baptized personally by Paul, is mentioned there in 1 Corinthians chapter 1. Jerry?
Again, Romans 16:23.
Did I miss one? When I was looking it up. Romans 16. Let's get over there real quick. A little far because I'm thinking instead of turning. Romans 16:23. Yeah, you're right. And I'm thinking trying to remember where was Paul when he wrote Romans? His epistle to Romans. Trying to remember where he was. Okay, you got me. He's one of the three, if I remember correctly. But now that I'm trying to think of it, it's not coming to me. So there's a possibility of another, but if I'm not mistaken, he's been identified as one of the others, one of his companions that was with him. And I would have to try to go back and figure it out. It may be of Derbe that he went with him, joined him at Troas, and went along with him.
I know it's my Bible says of Derbe.
They're where?
Corinth.
Okay. All right, so it's very possible that that's a guess and some consideration of one of them. Because there was a reference when I was studying this, a reference to one of those guests being mentioned as well in Romans 16, but it was one of those three, and I couldn't remember which one. So I'll have to go back and figure that one out. Because I didn't put it in the notes, and I forgot. Okay, well, anyway, this is the point of the Gaius of 3 John. We don't know which one he was. We have absolutely no way. There's not any indication from the text as to what congregation was under consideration here, of what the background of this individual may very well have been. You'll notice that all three of the men that we mentioned, and possibly the fourth mention in the Roman epistle, were all individuals who had some involvement with Paul, but there none of those three, there's any indication that there was any involvement with the Apostle John. Now, we have a situation in 3 John where there was obviously a friendship that had developed between the two men. Very tender expressions of love for Gaius, and the desire expressed in the latter part in the greetings at the end of the letter that they come and speak face to face. But other than that, we don't have any indication as to where the letter was sent to, what congregation he was a member of, or any other indication. All of that is if there are speculations. And by the way, you will, as you go through and read commentaries, you will find speculation about those things. But we don't know if one of the three that we've already mentioned or another Gaius entirely. Just so that you'll know that that's not something that can be ascertained before you get into the first study. So, a few minutes, but it didn't take a lot of time going through that material. Anybody have any questions, comments about the introductory material in the outline before we go on? All right, then what we want to do is just look at the discussion questions just to remind you of some similarities in the narratives of 1st, 2nd, 3rd John and some other things. before we get into the verse study. And the first question we have mentions some of the themes that are present in all three of John's letters. What are some of the things that John writes about in all three? Two things come immediately to mind to me.
Love and truth.
Love and truth. Good. Great minds think alike. Love and truth. So two of the continual themes, and the interesting thing in all three epistles he deals with this, is the necessity of love, the necessity of truth, and specifically walking in truth and obeying truth, and the intertwining of the two concepts, as in effect John takes time to define love as walking in truth, at least in part, and the reference to fidelity and faithfulness to God that we'll see. You look in this particular epistle, we've already read it. You'll notice in verse 3, I rejoice greatly when brethren came, testified of the truth that is in you. Just as you walk in the truth, I have no greater joy than to hear that my children walk in truth. You look back in 2 John, the same basic thing. Verse 4 of 2 John, I rejoice greatly I have found some of your children, the elect lady's children, walking in truth as we've received the commandment from the Father. There is also those expressions of tender feelings, the beloved Gaius, whom I love in truth. So love and truth are things that are tied up in these two epistles that are written to individuals, but also in 1 John. There is much that we have discussed with regard to those things. Yes,
okay. All three of them refers to little children a lot. And that may be part of that love, but it might be a little something else in that they're sort of his students or his spiritual offspring.
Yeah.
And he has continues to have that connection. He just had taught him and left him. He feels like they're part of his family.
Yeah, there's a sense of a proprietary sense about what his writings, these individuals to whom he writes, he has a great deal of affection for them. And as an elderly man and apostle of Jesus Christ, does consider them somewhat his children or offspring, those that he has begotten in the faith, those that he has nurtured. And that would, again, be, I think, very much in keeping with his personality and the way in which he is addressing them, the manner and feeling that he has for them, but just in the structure itself of his approach in his writing, especially in those two epistles. But there, as you indicate, a tenderness even expressed in 1 John 5, where it was to a greater group in his writings too. What else? Anything else that comes to mind with regard to themes in all three of the epistles? Yes, Dave?
Would be the love of God, like in verse 6, where it says that you journey in a manner worthy of God, that you will do well. So this worthy of God, to have love in it, and of course we know that in 1 John and 2 John, the same thing about loving God and Jesus the Christ.
I think that you can say, as an adjunct to that, that all three of the epistles deal with fellowship issues and questions concerning individuals who are, worthy of God's fellowship because of their teaching, because of their beliefs, those who are unworthy because of their teaching beliefs, and also not only because of doctrine, but also with regard to action. And this will be especially evident as we get into this discussion of doctrines. Here was an individual who was extremely unworthy because he was a divisive fellow and received very strong admonitions at the hand of John because of what he was doing. Whereas Gaius and also Demetrius, who are two individuals who are mentioned by name, are commended by John with regard to their activity. The other thing that I wanted to make note of is a treatment of brethren is something that seems to be present. There are commendations in these epistles concerning hospitality as to how individuals who are brethren coming in, how they're to be treated. And again, I think there's something intrinsic in the concept or the call for us to love. As John wrote in his first epistle, an individual who says he loves God and hates his brother, truth is not in him. you cannot love God whom you have not seen, if you do not love your brother whom you have seen. So the idea of treatment, especially treatment of brethren, is something that John was emphasizing. And of course, when you get into both 2 John with regard to the question of the fellowship of the false teacher, and 3 John with regard to Diotrephes' sins as he was refusing brethren and putting out others who would accept brethren, that those are indications of mistreatment of brethren that certainly were condemned by John in his epistles. So those are some of the things that have been present in our studies up to this point, some things that we'll be talking about in our discussion of 3 John as well. Right. Next question. John was an elderly man. Can you give me any scriptural citations of scripture to explain how the elderly are to be treated, especially what I have in mind are elderly Christians, how are they to be treated by other Christians? So, in other words, the older members of this congregation, and I define older as anyone who's older than you. I always indicate that. So there's only one in this group that this doesn't apply to. And I'm not going to say who. I don't even know who. I'm not going to say who. But it's something that, just to give the illustration with children, it's amazing how small a baby might be if they're able to sit up and they have some awareness, or you can hold them up in your arms. If they see a baby that is younger than them, then that's the baby. And they're, you know, they want to look at and hold and touch and pat on the baby, because the baby is smaller than they are. They may be very young themselves. And so it works the other way as well. So who is an older Christian, someone who's older than you? How do you treat them? And what does the Bible have to say about that? What are some scriptures that we can turn to? Yes, sir?
1 Timothy 5:1. Do not rebuke an older man, the exhorting of the father.
Okay, that's a very good passage of scripture. In fact, one of the ones that I had made note of myself, 1 Timothy 5, and you'll notice also in read verse 1 of the text. It actually continues on with regard to older women as well. Do not rebuke an older man, but exhort him as a father. Younger men as brothers. That is, this is how you treat a younger man as brothers, and older women as mothers. Now, he's specifically talking to the young evangelist Timothy as to how you're to treat or how you're to conduct yourself around those who are older. And there are some specific applications with regard to that. Specifically with regard to purity, as he talks about younger women as sisters with all purity, it's important that he be chaste with regard to his behavior toward them, younger men as brothers, but specifically with regard to older men and women, that with the idea of rebuking, and this is an important thing to consider. There are times when it becomes necessary to admonish any individual who is guilty of sin. And it is possible that someone older than you may be guilty of some sin, or making a mistake, or in need of some type of exhortation or admonition. And it's right and proper to do that, but how is it that you're to treat them? And the idea here of not rebuking an older man is not to approach an older man as if you are the one in authority. If you're the boss, and so you have the right to go to them in an unsparing way to basically tell them what for. You know, there are times when that actually is appropriate and beneficial and helpful. I think that fathers, for example, with regard to their children, from time to time, the children need to know that you do what you do because I told you to do it, because I'm your father. I brought you into this world. I take you out. That's what I told my kids. That's the old Bill Cosby quote. But anyway, just because I'm the father, because of my authority, because of who I am, and my right and my authority to tell you what to do, that's why you do it. But a child should never approach the father in that way. The child should always express with discretion this submission, this subservience, this attitude of of humility, even when it becomes necessary for him to disagree or to talk with his parents or to do something along those lines. And that's the attitude that a young evangelist should have toward older men. And so we're talking here about what is acknowledged very clearly in Scripture concerning older people, and that is that they are, as a result of age and experience, more likely to have wisdom. They have earned respect because of age and because of experience, and should be treated that way always. And I'm afraid sometimes that in a society and culture that worships youth, that sometimes older people are not given the proper respect and reverence that they need. And the reason I bring this up is because of the reference there of John as an elder and the practice of doctrophes, the way doctrophes treated John. And it was completely inappropriate. But here's an individual who's prideful, who maybe felt threatened in some way with regard to his standing in the church, and as such, he treated shabbily not only an older Christian, but an apostle of Jesus Christ. And it's hard for us to imagine someone having such pride and such arrogance to be willing to do that. That's an example that we find here. So this is instead the way they're to be treated. Yes?
It's not necessarily referring to Christians, but in Leviticus 19, verse 32, it says to rise before the gray-headed and honor the presence of an old man and fear the Lord.
Yeah, we're specifically talking about Christians, the behavior toward other Christians in the context of 3 John and such. But you're right, I think that the principle is one that's sadly lacking in our culture in general. And it should be one that is expressed by Christians in all circumstances.
Well, my point in bringing that up is, if we can do that for anyone other than that, how much more so and how much more should we honor and respect the elders?
And young people in the congregation, especially those of you who will be having children, one of the most important things that you can teach your children is to be respectful of those who are older than they. You know, it's a very important principle. And it's one that's sadly lacking. I may embarrass the two of them, but Brantley and Chad. One of the things that I remember from when they were very young is yes, ma'am, yes, sir, always. And there was a reason behind it, because the father was behind it. And he was directly behind it. If they didn't, he'd slap them on the back of the head and tell them to. But there's, you know, that kind of a desire to engender in them a great respect for those who are older. And people today talk about it as being just old-fashioned. But it's not old-fashioned. It's something that is an established Christian principle with regard to respect for the aged, and something we need to keep in mind. So it's a very important concept, and it's one that parents need to instill in their children. And doing that, I think, serves as, if you establish respect for those who are older, the concept of respect is the significant one there, less than respect for the older individual. Because respect, if it can be established in a young person for those who are older, it can also be established in them for those who are teachers and those who are police officers and those who are in positions of authority, those who are elders in the church. Respect for the father, respect for the mother. Respect is something that is an important thing, and an older person is certainly one who's worthy of that respect because of the life that he's lived and the experience that he has, and his position in life is one who's older. Someone says, "You've got to earn my respect." Well, he has. And that's one thing to kind of keep in mind is, no, everyone does not have to prove to you that they're worthy of respect. You have the responsibility by default to be respectful of individuals, regardless of whether you have seen it yourself or not. And I think that's a very typical problem in our society today, a lack of respect. So I thought I'd bring that up as well. Comments, questions? There are other passages, of course, that deal with it other than the one we mentioned. I had two others that I wrote down, but they're not specifically toward the elderly. They specifically refer to the elders. Also in 1 Timothy chapter 5, in verse 19, we said, "Do not receive an accusation against an elder, except from 2 or 3 witnesses." That's an indication, again, of respect. And then in Hebrews Hebrews epistle laid in that in the 13th chapter, both in verse. Get over there. It's hard for me to talk and turn at the same time for some reason. Hebrews 13, verse 7. Remember those who rule over you, who have spoken the word of God to you, whose faith follow, considering the outcome of their conduct. And then in verse 17, Hebrews 13, obey those who rule over you and be submissive, for they watch out for your souls as those who must give account. Let them do so with joy and not with grief, for that would be unprofitable for you. The reason I bring those up, not just because of the concept of the elders are elderly, but again, this idea of respect for authority, and again, to show a great contrast between what God expects with regard to our treatment of those who are in that position of authority, and the actual behavior of doctrophes with regard to John and his companions that we'll look at as we get into this next set. All right. Comments, questions about that particular discussion? Yes, sir.
This maybe is tangential, but I'm dealing with the older folks. I've noticed that when somebody has a talent or something they're maybe a little well known for, when they're in their 20s or 30s or 40s, it's right there on the surface, and you know what they're, you know, if the guy's a ball player, you know it in the first 2 minutes, you know what, whatever. When somebody's in their 70s or 80s and 90s, whatever they are, their big qualities are not right there on the surface like they used to be. And it takes a bit to get to know somebody to find out who they are, and I think a lot of times we don't do that. I've been just surprised so many times in my life of getting to know older people more to find out who they really are, instead of somebody who just talks slow and doesn't walk very fast, you know, and can't see well. That's what you see on the surface.
Right.
And you know, I've told the story before about one guy that had taken Dwight Eisenhower up in his airplane when he was in World War II. You know, you'd never know that looking at this person, you know, on the surface. I hang out at the senior center all the time now, so I see a lot of older folks. And one guy is in his 90s, and he's been a prolific songwriter and singer and guitar player. You can't tell that by looking at somebody.
Right.
You find out by talking to them for a while. And it's a worthwhile thing to do.
Certainly. It is worthwhile to get to know older people because of their character and nature. And you know, you've heard the expression, still waters run deep. And I think there's a lot of truth to that. As one gets older, they become more reflective. They begin to have physical problems that slow them down. And maybe not as athletic or as active as they once were. But there is a wealth of knowledge and experience that those who are younger can truly benefit from.
And the tie-in is, if you don't have that respect in the first place, you just kind of brush right by that. If you have some respect for them, you would assume that there's something more there. And there will be, I think, in most cases.
Amy?
There's
some
that you had just read kind of jumped out at me for the fact that it was talking about the elders and how if we behave this way toward them, that they will look over the flock with joy. And it kind of made me think, you know, as a parent, when your child's doing what they're supposed to be doing, and being respectful of you, and being polite and they're obeying, it gives you joy as a parent. When they rebel, it's such turmoil in the house, there's so many problems. Likewise, in the church, the elders are looking over us, and that act of joy is one if we're doing our part.
Yeah, it's interesting because you look at it, you approach it, and take from it that positive aspect. I've always, whenever I see that verse 17 in Hebrews 13, I will not say it's an overt threat, but I almost take it that way. Whenever I see that would be unprofitable for you. What does he mean by that? and there's something to be said to acknowledge that we have a situation, we're talking specifically about elders of the church. We have a situation where there is an important office to which they have been appointed. God has basically established, first of all, in every congregation there needs to be men whose responsibility is the care for the flock. The purpose of these men's, their actions and behavior is to watch out for the souls of men. Nothing is more important than that. And what it's basically saying here is, you don't want to make their job hard. If you make their job hard, it's not going to go well for you. That's not a physical threat. It has reference to the fact that God has put them in this place. God expects for you to be a joy to them, not a headache for them. And God is going to be taking notes concerning that and causing such a heartache and headache is something that we will give an account for in the day of judgment.
Following that thread, if the elders get discouraged enough, they may decide they don't want to pick the office at all. And what is a horrible thing for the church, what an unprofitable situation for all, happens because of one person or a group of persons that make their job difficult. And God will hold us responsible for causing the other that kind of discouragement, I believe.
Very good. Good points. All right. All right, let's continue on then to the last two questions in the discussion material. What characteristics about Gaius, as we read through, and that's one of the reasons I read those verses in the greeting. Going down into verse 5 through 8, beloved, you do faithfully whatever you do for the brethren and for strangers who have borne witness of your love before the church. You send them forward on their journey in a manner worthy of God. You'll do well because they went forth for his name's sake, taking nothing from the Gentiles. We therefore ought to receive such that we may become fellow workers for the truth. Verses 5 through 8. But what are some of the characteristics about Gaius that are most commendable as listed by John here in the text?
Of course, it's love for the truth.
Love for the truth. Okay.
Hospitality.
Hospitality. Those are probably the two things that are most overtly expressed in the text. Love for the truth and hospitality. You'll do note that hospitality especially is toward Christians. The expression, as the Apostle Paul indicated in Galatians chapter 6, is do good to all, but especially to those who are the household of faith. It's a very great benefit and to you personally if you are hospitable to those whose purpose is to disseminate and preach the truth. And this is, by the way, a very strong contrast with what we discussed in the second epistle, where you had individuals who were being hospitable to individuals who are not worthy. So there is a key here as to who it is. There's a limit as to who you can be hospitable to. Those who are unworthy because they do not bring the doctrine of Christ, you're not to greet them or to open your house to them. But those who are preaching and spreading the gospel of our Lord, those are individuals who are worthy of hospitality. And not only the love for truth, but again, defined with regard to the love of truth is walking in truth. Again, when we say, okay, what is the love of truth? It doesn't mean that you really enjoy reading it. You know, it carries with it more than that. The Holy Spirit defines what the love for truth is, and the love for God is. And it's very much tied in with obedience, and there is an emphasis that is placed there upon obedience. Okay. Anybody else with regard to Gaius? Yes, sir.
His soul was prosperous. That's commendable.
Okay. Yeah, he had prospered. It's obvious his prosperity, though, was not merely financial, that he was spiritually prosperous as well. Okay, good. All right, last question. Question number 4. Can we determine the identity of Gaius? We've already discussed that in general. Anybody want to add anything to that? Yes.
Well, not exactly his identity, but I think he must have been an influential member of the church that John was writing to him to kind of obviously to counter Diotrephes' actions.
Right? Yeah.
And so he was. I think it was more than just trying to encourage Gaius, but maybe encourage him to some action.
Yeah, we're going to actually talk about that a little bit when we get into the discussion, and I'll presage it by making this point. If you have an individual, one single individual in a congregation that is running a church, which is what Diotrephes was doing, that is wreaking havoc, that is putting people out, that is causing strife. And the reason why that is because the rest of the members of the congregation are allowing him to do it. I want you to think about that one, because it's true. One thing that is evident when we look at Scripture is that those individuals who are guilty of sin, they need to be dealt with. And we're talking about ultimately, as we discussed already, and we're talking about the limits of Christian fellowship and such. From time to time, it becomes necessary to withdraw ourselves from an individual, to expel him from a congregation. And this can be done. But it takes will. It takes a purpose on our part. And it becomes much more difficult if the individual who is under consideration is a willful person who considers himself either in a position where he can be running things or should be running things. And that can make it a bit more difficult. But it still has to be done. And now I'm not saying that it's easy. And by the way, not saying that that every Christian in the congregation is in a position where they can take a lead in doing that. But there are always individuals who can. And their responsibility in those situations is to do something about it. And I do think, as Roger alluded to, this letter that John is writing, if he acknowledged the fact that he is writing about a situation that is extant, that is there, it's present, and it's a bad situation, it's causing problems, and it is basically a particular individual, well, why in the world does that individual who's doing wrong have the ability to put people out of the church that are doing right? How could that happen? It can only happen if those who are doing right like it. It's a battle of will. It's who's going to be strong-minded enough. It's not a physical thing. It's a physical thing called the cops. I mean, we're talking about a battle of wills here as to who's going to stand up to it. And that indicates that even good Christians, because Gaius is an individual who's being acknowledged as one who walks in the truth, has a love for the truth, and himself being hospitable, maybe he was doing these things and he didn't care what Diotrephes said, he was going to do it anyway. It didn't change the fact that Diotrephes was in a controlling posture in regard to this particular congregation he needed to be dealt with. So I do think that John was bolstering Gaius and indicating that there was a need to do something about it in that congregation. And we have the responsibility to do the same. And in fact, when you talk about the exercise of discipline, there is often a call for being long-suffering and patient with men. But a divisive man, how many warnings does he get?
One or two.
Not two. One or two. And I mean, that's kind of an indication that there are certain circumstances sometimes when you give him a warning and he's persistent in it, get rid of him right then. It may be the best thing for the congregation, best thing for the welfare of the brethren. He just gets kicked out immediately because of the type of person he is and the kind of actions that he's the problems that he's causing. And so sometimes it's necessary to act quickly in circumstances like that. A strife-causing individual is something that is perhaps the most disruptive instrument in a group of people, a group of Christians. And it needs to be dealt with quickly. All right? Yes, sir.
Ran across something that I've kind of not been able to reconcile yet. Verse 7 says, "For they have gone out for the sake of the name, accepting nothing or receiving nothing or taking nothing, depending on your translation, from the Gentiles." Now, is that talking about those outside the church or just those that are not Jewish? Or
no, I think the reference there is that when you have individuals who are going out and preaching the gospel, that they're not making merchandise of the gospel.
Okay.
So the principle is, let's say it would give a parallel today, those who are doing missionary work in the Philippines or in India, something like that. It's good for you to support them, to help them as they go forward. Because when they go out there, they're not going to be taking anything from the people that they're preaching to.
Okay.
And so they're going to need some support and need help. Now, and by the way, just to make this point, we brethren, we have a congregation that we receive letters in the mail, for example, requests from gospel preachers with regard to the preaching of the gospel. We need support. And it would be inappropriate for us to ever have a mindset that these preachers are coming and begging for money. You know, that we're and be put off by. Now, we may not be able to fill the requests. You know, the elders have the responsibility of determining the best way in which the monies that are brought in by the congregation are to be utilized, and it may not include this particular request or petition. But for us to have the idea or attitude that it's in some way demeaning, an unpleasant thing, an inappropriate thing for preachers to request help and support to go preach the gospel, even if it's continual requests, even if it's repeated requests, even if, you know, the work that they're doing is an expensive work, if it's a worthy work, then it is appropriate for them to ask for such support. And I think sometimes when I see these things, you know, maybe it's because of how often it happens, but at least get a little bit burned out about the continual requests for monies. But there's nothing that is more important than the work of preaching. And they're not going to go out and say, I'm going to preach to you, but I want $5 from you first. It didn't work that way. And so they're going to need the help of brethren as they go out and proclaim the gospel. And it's a good thing anytime that you can help. Either as a congregation we can help, or individual. All right. Appreciate very much everyone's kind attention today. We'll pick up with the verse study next.